Lou Manfredini here. Do you have cracked or sunken concrete areas around your home? Call PermaSeal for a free estimate. Don't replace it, raise it. Call 800-421-7325 or visit permaseal.net.
All right, Reggie. How you doing, my friend? Cool. All right. How about we do a little podcast? Now, there's a novel idea, right? All right. Very good, sir. Why don't you get what you have to do in your room, and I'll get all my preparations done in here, and then we will merge those, and we will create something that, when we're finished, an hour before had not existed. Isn't that interesting? Think about that, right? This podcast right now does not exist, but in an hour from now or so, it will. Weird. In the words of George Carlin, weird. Okay, you don't even know who George Carlin is, do you? All right, my friend, go ahead. Get ready here. Put it in the books. This is episode 491. I'll give you the three S's, star, smile, strong. And here we go. Get ready to hit that record button on one. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Of course, I love it when you listen, but I also really appreciate it when you get out there and tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is, in fact, Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And gee, why isn't it theirs too? It should be. Get out there and spread that word. We need a little PR in this world. If you don't pump yourself up these days, who will? I do appreciate folks posting it on their Facebook page and things like that. I really do. So thank you so much. Your loyalty and longtime devotion are much appreciated. Of course, for anybody out there who's listening, old or new fans, or should I say not old, longtime or newer fans, if you want to continue to listen to this, you know, old episodes are always there at WGNRadio.com. You go to the website there, you hit the prompt for this podcast, and there you go. And they are there. Load more and scroll down. There, go back several years. We've been doing this for almost 10. And in fact, this is episode 491. So I wanted to talk today about a film and a project that will be coming out this week. As anybody who listens to this podcast with any kind of regularity should know, I certainly, in addition to being a huge Elton John fan, thus the name Elton Jim, thus the name Captain Podtastic, and actually, I might be doing a podcast about that album, Captain Fantastic, because it will be it's celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. In May, it actually turned 50, but there's going to be an expanded version of a 50th anniversary reissue of that. And so maybe I will talk about that. I've always made reference to it, but I think it deserves its own podcast. What do you say? I think so. But that's for another day. Right now, we're talking about this. Another new reissue, expanded musical compilation that comes out with an upcoming movie coming out at the end of this week. And so I thought that would make a lot of sense for us to do. Do both at the same time. To celebrate Bruce Springsteen's upcoming film called Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, which will star Jeremy Allen White, of course, from The Bear, as Bruce Springsteen. And it will chronicle a very short and very specific time period in Bruce Springsteen's life and career, the making of his album Nebraska, which came out in 1982. And to coincide with the film that talks about the making of this album, well, you know, in today's world, especially when you sell your back catalog for $500 million. Bruce Springsteen sold his back catalog a few years ago for a reported $500 million. Yeah, I understand there's taxes involved and withholdings, but it's still a pretty good chunk of change that went finally into his bank account. So the people that own those publishing rights now and that catalog, they've got to find a way to make that money back. And if you've noticed over the last couple of years since Springsteen did sell his catalog to Columbia Pictures, to Sony, so it's still Columbia Records and Sony, so it still stays within the family of where Bruce Springsteen has been recording his entire career for Columbia Records, dating back to 1973 with his Greetings from Asbury Park album. So, hey, look, Columbia and Sony have been making money off of Bruce Springsteen's music for more than 50 years. Nothing new. But now they actually own them. And so, yeah, they're going to have to try to make back that that investment. And when you think about it, it sounds like a huge amount of money, certainly $500 million. But I guess when you look at the catalog of Bruce Springsteen, even though from a album standpoint, I mean, there's no question Born in the USA remains his biggest selling album, and I don't even know if albums will sell like that anymore, because those were back in the 80s when people used to really buy records. I think that album sold 15, 16, 17 million copies, some outrageous number, which catapulted him from a rock star into a mega star. If you look at it, I'm sure if you look at it from the long haul, yeah, I mean, Springsteen and his heirs will certainly have that money to play with, but I would bet that in the long run, Columbia Sony made a pretty good deal, considering how Bruce Springsteen's music most likely will continue through the decades, if not the centuries. Maybe not everyone, but certainly his name and certainly a good amount of his songs. And so, yeah, it sounds like it's a crazy investment. I mean, you've been hearing about a lot of these artists selling their back catalogs, but people don't spend $200 or $300 million unless they decide or figure out how they're going to make that money back. So anyway, you've heard, I don't know if you've seen a few TV shows or commercials, but suddenly, very subtly, Springsteen music is starting to crop up more and more into commercials and into television shows. And that's going to be one way that, aside from official releases or anniversary issues or remasters or whatever they would be, in addition to those, I think you're going to also see certainly Springsteen's music being used, excuse me, in some certain other ways to recoup that investment. And no question, as I said, I've noticed there was a commercial. I can't remember what it was for, which is not good for the advertiser. But it was about a year ago or so, maybe, or it was last summer. I'm not sure when. There was a little young girl, maybe a 3 or 4 year old girl, either learning to walk or learning to run, and they didn't have Bruce Springsteen's version of Born to Run, but they had the music to it as a background for this commercial. It was subtle. It was a cute commercial. I think it was a heartstrings kind of tugging thing. And in the background, you heard, the Born to Run music. I was watching an episode of Wednesday, the TV show, the stream show about the Addams Family character Wednesday. And there was a very obvious reference. There was in one of the episodes, there was a big bonfire that was going to happen. And suddenly in the background, you hear the strains of Dancing in the Dark, because there's a line in there that says you can't start a fire without a spark. And in fact, one of the characters makes a reference and name checks Bruce Springsteen and that lyric in the episode. So for those who say, oh, wow, what a sellout, what a sellout. I mean, in today's music world and in today's entertainment world, I don't even think there's such thing as a sellout. Artists today are not worried about the musical, integrity. They used to, including Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen was very protective of his catalog for many years. But I think, you know, when the dollar signs, when those kind of dollar signs come a-knocking, I think you have to start to say, well, maybe I could be tempted by that. Who can blame anyone, right? But, you know, mostly the 60s and 70s rockers, they had that, that social activism, that hippie mantra that they grew up with and they were ascribing to for many years. And in the 80s, especially when rock really took a jump forward, and I've mentioned this many times about MTV, when MTV became so huge in the early and mid 80s, and music became much more commercialized. Now it was a visual medium in addition to an audio medium. Well, then everything just changed, and suddenly, with the music so popular, and now the artists so popular, because their faces and their images were being sold in addition to their music. That always happened, right? I mean, you know, the images and personalities were always a part of rock and roll, going back to its early days with Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis. That was always a part of it. Elvis's look was just as important as his music, if in some cases, perhaps even more so. And so that's always been there, but certainly in the 80s, it really changed in its tenor. It totally changed, and a lot of rock stars started to do commercials or let their music be used for it. And there was a lot of controversy within the music period. And now this is 40 years ago, though. But you know, there was always this term, a sellout. You were selling out, selling your integrity. Selling out your music for money. And that was considered a bad thing. You know, you were supposed to remain pure. You were doing this for the music, not for the money, even though at the end of the day, they were all doing it for the music. But they were putting forth this image that they were these, these committed troubadours who lived and breathed the music, and it made for a nice romantic tale. As time went on, a lot of that mythology broke down. I have to say though, if there's any one artist who has been, for the most part, and he's had his moments, who's been fairly consistent in trying to maintain that integrity, it's been Neil Young. He came out in the 80s with a song called "This Note's for You," which was a very bitter and damning statement on those rock stars who were selling their music for commercials or for money at the time in the 80s. I remember Joe Jackson didn't want to do a video. I mean, there was just because he felt that it was cheapening the music. There was a lot of artistic pushback against the commercialization of music, even though it has always been there. The outward impression that many of the rock stars were trying to at least create for them was that they were musical purists, and that the music was the driving force, not the money. But all at the same time, when you see, they all have huge houses, and they all, you know, so there was a little hypocrisy going on. But it certainly became this kind of rallying cry for that 60s hippie naivete of, oh, you know, the term sellout used to be something that hovered over the music industry. And then somewhere in the 90s, that went away. And we saw people like Michael Jackson, even in the 80s and things like that, doing Pepsi commercials. And some of the biggest stars were making these commercials. And suddenly, I think the music purists sort of either got overrun by the way the music world was coming, or they got tempted by the music too. I mean, I remember in the 80s, Lou Reed, right? Okay, from Velvet Underground, Walk on the Wild Side. You can't get much more, I guess, non-commercialized than a guy like Lou Reed. But you know what? In the 80s, even he gave in. He did a Honda scooter commercial and print ad. And I never forget going, wow, okay, if Lou Reed's doing it, it looks like everybody else is going to do it too. And that's really what happened. In the 90s then, when you had the growth of the pop divas and the boy bands, there was no question. And the rap and the hip-hop artists, they were seeking out sponsorships. They were seeking out to be spokespeople. They weren't stepping away from that. They didn't feel, you know, that new group in the 90s and the early 2000s, that's where this whole idea of a brand, your brand, came in. That was suddenly a part of the music world and a part of the pop culture world. And it kind of made all the bands from the 60s and 70s and even some of the 80s, kind of have to sort of turn around and say, okay, you know what? That's the way this music world is going. If you use the term sellout now, you are showing your age. Any artist today is looking for some kind of corporate sponsorship. The Rolling Stones took a lot of heat. Their tours were sponsored by major companies. I remember they sold the rights to Start Me Up to Microsoft, I think. And that was a big deal. Oh, the Stones have sold out. The Stones have been selling out for years. When they created that lips and tongue logo, what do you think that was? That was merchandising, my friends. So there's always been a little hypocrisy in rock and roll with the commercialization as opposed to the art. It's just that now it's more blatant, it's more accepted. There's no facade. Now it's just, yeah, you know, I'll sell myself to the highest bidder. And look, they've been doing that to some extent all the time. And so, as I said, Bruce Springsteen, obviously now you will start to see a lot more of his, not only whatever new music he may make, but I'm sure you're going to start to see a lot more of his older work as every album from the 70s and 80s, has a special anniversary. All these legacy stars that go back 50 or 60 years, you will start to see more box sets and more reissues of their old popular albums to either reintroduce to their longtime fans with some extras or introduce to a whole new generation. And so that's what's going on right now with this project. As I said, with Bruce Springsteen, the film comes out on Friday. I have not seen it. But in addition to the film, to coincide with that, there will be this new expanded edition of Nebraska 82, it's called, with not only a remastered version of the album, but a new live recording, a solo live recording of all the original songs that Springsteen did without an audience at a theater, the Count Basie Theater in New Jersey, earlier this year, as well as then what makes all these expanded versions and box sets so enticing for longtime fans especially is the bonus material. And what is intriguing about this entire Nebraska project that now is getting its film, on Friday, October 24th, as well as to coincide with it, this expanded Nebraska 82, the expanded edition box set that comes in vinyl as well as in CD. So you're going to get the audio portion of what sparked the film, and then you're going to get this film version, obviously fictionalized to some extent, but based on a true story, as they say, with Jeremy Allen White as Bruce Springsteen and Jeremy Strong as his manager, John Landau. And then you'll get this visual representation, a Hollywood version of the making of this album. And so for many people, the question might be, what's Nebraska? And I'll tell you, that's a legitimate question. And if you are a casual Bruce Springsteen fan, you might say, well, I've heard of Born to Run, and I've heard of Born in the USA, and I've heard some other songs, obviously, or other albums over the years, but what's Nebraska? And I'll be honest with you, for many Bruce Springsteen fans, Nebraska has been an oddity since it came out. And it really is has been an interesting kind of growth and emergence of this album and this period in Springsteen's career that, like so much of it, has taken on kind of a mythic proportion. And I'll be honest, to do a movie about this, you would think, oh, you know, I mean, you see the Bohemian Rhapsody film and the Rocket Man film about Elton John, Bohemian Rhapsody about Queen, and it sort of gives this career overview. The Springsteen film will be very specific. It'll basically cover maybe a 1 or 2 year period in his life and his career with some flashbacks to his earlier life as to how that earlier life may have been infused into the writings of this song. But you're not going to see the Bruce Springsteen that you know so well, the casual fan, with the headband and the muscles and Clarence Clemens and the E Street Band from Born in the USA with the jeans and the red baseball cap in the back pocket. You're not going to see the Born to Run Bruce Springsteen with the wool cap on his head and the beard and the whole band wearing hats in the 70s. You're not going to see that. This is a very short period of time just before he became a megastar and released this album in 1982, as I said before, called Nebraska. And I can speak to this from firsthand experience, having been a Bruce Springsteen fan now for going on, I don't even want to admit how long. All I can say is that the Born to Run album was one of my, 12 free Columbia Record and Tape Club picks for a penny. So that's how far back I go with Bruce Springsteen. I was literally in grammar school. And so I've been a fan of his for many, many years, many decades. And I have distinct memories of the Nebraska period. And it's been so funny how over the last 40-some years, this album, which, as I said before, is an oddity, it's a mystery, it was so strange at the time. It was such a contradiction at the time. And in many ways, even now, though, that it's taken on legendary proportions, and some people, despite the big booming Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band sound of Born in the USA, Darkness on the Edge of Town, The River, Born to Run, and albums like that, this album doesn't include any of that. It doesn't include the big rousing roadhouse songs, well, maybe one or so, but this is more of a very dark, a very sparse, introspective, desperate, isolated album, which in many ways reflects where Bruce Springsteen was. And I think to understand this album, you have to understand where he was coming from. And I think the movie, from what I've seen and what I've read about it, will certainly try to do that, to explain. But it's really funny that you would think that, like, for instance, I mean, you know, could you do a Queen movie without showing the triumphant Live Aid performance or songs like Bohemian Rhapsody or things like that? This song is not going to have, or this album or this movie is not going to have these iconic Bruce Springsteen songs. If anything, for some people, it's going to be songs they've never heard before, which you would think after a 50-year career, could there be any songs that even a casual listener hasn't heard? But I guarantee you there will be. But I'm not surprised because, you know, Bruce Springsteen's career is always, as much as it's been very big and very exposed, he's always tried to go down different paths, which has made his career very interesting, very diverse, and very creative and artistic. But at the same time, it also has been head-scratching for longtime fans. And that's why I think it's so funny that Nebraska has become what many consider his greatest album, and yet it is completely different than whatever the average casual Bruce Springsteen fan might expect. There's no Clarence Clemons. There's no blaring saxophone. You know, there's no electric guitar. It's this very stripped down. It's not a party album at all. In fact, if anything, as I said once again, it goes against such the grain. Many of the songs deal with violence and criminal behavior. You know, some real serious stuff here, murders, and those are the protagonists here. These are not, people to necessarily rejoice or celebrate. One of them is a well-known serial killer named Charlie Starkweather, which the song Nebraska itself is about. It leads off the album, and it actually was named, the song, you know, is the title track. And so I can speak from first hand experience, because now, you know, 40 some years later, as more people have discovered it, especially younger artists who have heard Nebraska, and I think it really is a singer-songwriter's kind of inspirational album, especially if you are a big pop star and whose music has grown and become big. I mean, I know for sure a major fan of Nebraska is Ed Sheeran, who's one of the biggest stars in the world. And his music is played all over the place. But he cites Nebraska as a huge influence for him. And I can understand that if you're a songwriter, because these songs are so intimate and personal and bare bones. They literally are demo versions. You know, so often we hear about bootlegs or bootleg albums that were never meant to be released, and the albums get some of the songs and the tapes, they get leaked, or somebody gets access to them and they put them out on an album or a CD, and that's called, you know, a bootleg. It's not an official release. And those have been going on since the beginning of time with rock and roll. There were, you know, concerts were recorded, by people with a little hand recorder in the audience, and they put them on vinyl and they would sell them. As I said, people in the studio would get access to these songs by an artist. They wouldn't get released. And all of a sudden, there was a whole subculture of bootlegs. Now, it's not as much, once again, a subculture because streaming, you know, and Napster. I mean, well, Napster's gone, but in terms of digital music has kind of destroyed that. But there was this underground world of demos, and if you were a big fan, or if you are a big fan of some artist, whether it's Taylor Swift or, you know, Bruce Springsteen, whoever it might be, you love to hear the demos. Like, what was, you know, you've heard the fully produced songs, but if you really are into an artist and you start to really, you know, dig deep into their music and the creative process, it's intriguing for you to hear, okay, where did the catalyst and the germ of this idea for this song, how did it come about? And you hear basically so many times, if you hear demo versions of just, you know, strums of a guitar and little wisps of the lyrical content that later would become some of the most well-known lyrics in pop history. And so that's what Nebraska really is. It was one of the first officially released bootleg albums. I mean, this should have been the germs of the song, where they started from. These should have been fully blown, fully produced songs that came out on an album, and these versions that are on Nebraska would have been, oh, but here's what they started from. Just these very sparse guitar, driven, acoustic-driven songs. So there is a history to this. There is a background to this. In 1981, Bruce Springsteen, finally, really 1980 and then into 81. In 1980, Bruce Springsteen finally fulfilled the promise. There was huge, huge hype about Bruce Springsteen right from the get-go. When he was signed to Columbia in 1973, he was being touted as the new Dylan. And his first album, Greetings from Asbury Park, had a Dylan-esque style to it, not so much musically, but certainly lyrically. A lot of rhymes, songs like Blinded by the Light and Growing Up and things like that. They were very Dylan-esque. And the album really, it had a lot of critical acclaim, a lot of hype by CBS as the new Dylan, who also, Columbia, also had Bob Dylan on its label. But it didn't really ever become a big hit at all. I mean, in 1973, you know, the number one song was Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree. Not exactly, if you listen to Greetings from Asbury Park, you can't see how any of the Bruce Springsteen songs on that album could have ever been on the same radio stations that were playing Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree, okay? And then his second album, there was a lot of expectation, still a lot of hype. And even that one was even more non-commercialized. It's known mostly by the casual fan for the album that includes Rosalita, the big kind of rousing rocker that has become a concert staple. But that album was very jazz-like, if you will. Jazz and rock, very kind of almost Van Morrison-like. Certainly not commercial at all. And once again, if you look at what was on the charts in 1974 when it came out, there's no way that any of these songs, which many of them were over 5 or 6 minutes, were ever going to get on AM radio, which still was in a world of you can only play 3 minute songs. When Born to Run came out in 1975, it was certainly hailed as a rock classic, and the song Born to Run was very popular, and the hype machine for Born to Run was again huge, to the point where Bruce Springsteen, a relatively unknown artist, got on the cover of the same week on Time and Newsweek when Born to Run came out. And regardless of that hype, and regardless of the quality of a song like Born to Run and on that album, and Thunder Road, and She's the One, and Jungle Land, and so many, 10th Avenue Freeze Out, so many classic Bruce Springsteen songs. While Born to Run did well, it was not a number one album. Born to Run song was not a number one song. And while it was heavily hyped, there was a lot of backlash because there was so much hype. Everybody was saying Columbia keeps you know, hyping the heck out of the Springsteen guy. And yeah, there's something there, but you know, it's not the second coming. Now, what was always been interesting about Bruce Springsteen's career, while the albums were always hailed by the critics and appreciated by the general public, but just a small portion of it, his live performances as a concert performer, that's where his legend grew. And he still is known as one of the greatest concert and live performers in the history of rock and roll. It's always been an interesting dichotomy that his albums seem to be one aspect of him, his recorded albums, and then his live show is almost something completely different, which makes him an interesting and intriguing artist and somebody that takes chances and somebody that is unpredictable in many ways and who can follow many roads and is lucky enough to have an audience that will take those artistic and those creative chances and those creative detours with him. He doesn't just make albums for the masses the same way during a formula all the time. If anything, he's continually broken the mold. And whenever he's had any kind of major mainstream success, he usually follows that up with a very uncommercial album. And it's been consistent that way. And the first time that happened was with Nebraska. When he got into a legal dispute, I was talking about his publishing. Well, you know, he had a legal dispute with his publishing and his catalog early in his career, which kept him out of the studio for almost a year and a half or 2 years. And when that was settled, he came back in around 1978 with which many will consider one of his greatest albums, Darkness on the Edge of Town. Once again, from a Bruce Springsteen musical catalog standpoint, it includes The Promised Land and Darkness on the Edge of Town and Prove It All Night and Candy's Room and just many, you know, Racing in the Street, some classic Bruce Springsteen songs. However, not a hit. No hit singles. Prove It All Night, Promised Land, no, not big hits at all. The album sold well. Once again, Bruce Springsteen, for the most part, had always been a cult artist with a huge following. He was a popular cult artist. It makes no sense on paper, but that's what he was. Because his live show was so exciting and different and word of mouth spread. And everybody would even say, oh, you know, you got to, if you get a Bruce Springsteen album, people would play it when they go, oh, it's okay. And they'd say, yeah, but you got to see him in concert. You got to see him in concert. And that's where the conversion has always happened, in concert, not so much on the albums. Because I think when Bruce Springsteen goes into the studio, he clicks on a different mindset in terms of the music. And there's a different mindset when he talks about, when he thinks about how to present himself in the concert setting. And they're two different worlds. And most of the time, especially in today's world, it's almost a carbon copy. What you hear on record is what you see in concert. For Springsteen, it's always been very different. And so he was I would argue that despite all the hype and all the notoriety and all the critical acclaim, for the most part, he was a cult artist. but very well known and very popular. People heard of them. People heard of them. They may not have seen them, but then when other people told, you got to go see Bruce Springsteen, like I said, that's when the conversion happened. And everything really changed for Bruce Springsteen in 1980. He had a lot of songs written while he couldn't record for a couple of years because of these legal matters. He was still writing songs. As one of his longtime friends and collaborators and bandmates says, Bruce always had at least two or three songs in his back pocket, all time. Very prolific, no question. And during that down period, he wrote a lot of music. So he had a lot of backlog of songs. And after the release of Darkness on the Edge of Town, the idea was, how do we, meaning Columbia Records, management, Bruce Springsteen himself, how do we best present, as I said before, this kind of dichotomy, these two personalities that were happening in the Bruce Springsteen creative world, this recording artist and this live performer. And with The River in 1980, the goal was, we are going to try our best to merge these two for the first time so that the recording artist and the live artist is presented all at once. And it was a huge success. The River became a number one album. He had a top 10 hit with Hungry Heart, and he finally broke through. In 1980 was finally, when he was about 31 years old, finally the fulfillment of the promise, the fulfillment of the hype. The hype that started in 1973, 7 years later, of Bruce Springsteen is going to be a very important, huge star, the next Dylan at the time. It took 7 years for him to finally achieve what was promised by so many, to finally reach that potential. There were many of us who saw that and were into it a long time before, but it wasn't until The River, which was a double album, a very diverse, sprawling, wide-ranging album of roadhouse rockers, hard rockers, soul rockers, almost punkish, dark, intimate ballads with the E Street Band at its peak. It had the Clarence Clemons saxophones. It had the pounding Max Weinberg drums. It had the staccato pounding sounds of Roy Bittan's piano and the swirling organs of Danny Federici, and Springsteen's patented gravel growling voice, and Steve Van Zandt's screeching guitar solos and harmonies with Bruce, and Gary W. Talent's solid bass lines. And that's the E Street Band. And there really is no better E Street Band album than The River. And I often say that when people say, well, if you want to talk about Bruce Springsteen, I would say, listen to The River, because it's all there. That's the essence of the Bruce Springsteen sound. So he puts out The River. It finally breaks him as a major star, not a superstar. Well, I would even say maybe a superstar, but not a megastar legend, which would happen 4 years later with Born in the USA. The River took off so fast that in October of 1980, Bruce Springsteen, for instance, in Chicago, was playing, I believe it was the Uptown Theater, probably holds 2,000 or 3,000 people. A month later, he was at the Rosemont Horizon, which held 15,000. That's how fast The River exploded. And that was my first concert in 1980, in November of 1980, at the Rosemont Horizon. That's where I first saw him. I was only a teenager at the time. So now, and that tour and that album took him through 1981, the end of 1980 and throughout 1981. And so finally, the promise was fulfilled. And so now there was, now Bruce Springsteen was no longer a cult hero. He was a major rock star. In many ways, he always was a major rock star. It's just that now the general public finally caught up. It took them 7 years, and they finally caught up. And so, of course, the expectations for the new, for the next Bruce Springsteen, now that he was on people's radar screens, female as well as male, he had the whole thing going for him. He was a concert attraction. He was a record seller. He had this rock and roll image with the, at that time, you know, still kind of the dark, you know, rugged troubadour. He would wear the Elvis sideburns a lot and things like that. But if you saw him in concert, he was a wild man. But the image was there. There was a mythology that was being written about him. This, you know, this New Jersey middle class struggling, you know, streetwise guy who romanticized the rock and roll myths and legends of cars and girls and summer nights. It was all happening finally. The whole mythology, the music, the image, the live performance, it all coalesced in 1980 and 1981. As I said, the promise was fulfilled. Actually, a song called The Promise, which is one of my favorite Bruce Springsteen songs, which was an outtake, which really should have been released, but that's another story. But so, great expectations now for Bruce Springsteen for his next release. Everybody's waiting. Now he's got a whole new fan base of people who are so excited. They finally have they've tapped into what many of us had been tapped into for many years before, musically and especially live. And so now, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? You know, is there going to, what's going to be the next Cadillac Ranch or Hungry Heart or Out in the Street? The big rousing rockers that define the E Street Band sound. Bruce Springsteen fans, young and old, longtime and newbies, were looking forward for the next album. Wow. After the River. Holy cow. Now he's really going to set the world on fire. This brought him into the mainstream, and wow, this next one is going to take him to the stratosphere. That was the expectation. And what we find out later, many years later, is that Bruce Springsteen, while outwardly to the public, was a smiling, happy, especially in concert, funny, entertaining, crowd pleasing. The pictures of him, you know, were always these kind of, you know, really ultra cool James Dean-ish Elvis things of, you know, playing, you know, the arcade, and of course the Jersey Shore was a part of the mythology as well. But meanwhile, the Bruce Springsteen offstage was very different. He came from a very dysfunctional family with a father with mental disease. At that time, who knew what bipolar was? Who knew what some of these things were back in the 60s and 70s and even 80s? But he came from a very dysfunctional family. And he himself had a lot of demons. And you'd listen to the music and you'd hear the demons. And you'd hear these songs, especially about the relationship with his father, which was very turbulent. And you'd hear about the upbringing in little bits and pieces through the characters that he created. Many people thought that all of his songs were autobiographical, and like every artist, there are portions of songs that may have been taken from their real lives, but Bruce Springsteen in many ways is a true writer. He is a true creative. In fact, in his autobiography, he starts it by saying, "This was all a magic trick. I've been writing about cars my whole career, but I never had a driver's license until I was in my early 20s or late mid-20s. So all this romanticism about girls and cars and summer nights, it was in the imagination of Bruce Springsteen. He obviously had some knowledge of it, but these weren't autobiographical songs, but he was able to sell them and write them and sing them in such a genuine, honest, raw way that it felt like he was talking about himself. And there were portions or little snippets from his real life, as I said before, that were infused into his songs. But they weren't strictly autobiographical, even though in many ways they were presented that way, and they certainly resonated with people that way. And so what's been so interesting, if you look at Bruce Springsteen's career in the long haul, as somebody who has been with him for a majority of that, you will see that whenever he would reach a pinnacle, a huge moment of overwhelming success, rather than building on that and taking it to another step, he retreated from it and almost went in the opposite direction to diffuse it. And it was frustrating in so many ways, and it was disappointing in many ways, and it was confusing to say, what's this? There's been many times in Bruce Springsteen's career that when a new album came out, I guarantee you, I know I've said it, and I'm sure other fans too, well, what's this? And then with repeated listenings, you begin to understand it, but that first impression would be, what's this, and where did this come from, and why? It's because Bruce Springsteen seems to have always wanted to reinvent himself or find himself. Maybe the idea was that Bruce Springsteen that we knew was the invention. And perhaps this 50 years has been, how do I reveal my real self? We fans took it the other way, that we were seeing the real one, and he was somehow reinventing himself into from a rock soul roadhouse rocker into a Woody Guthrie folky. But maybe that's where he always was. And the Bruce Springsteen image was the myth. And he basically said as much in his autobiography many, 40 years later. But so that was always the great mystery. So, and as I said, in many ways, the great disappointment. Huge expectations for the follow-up to The River in 1981 and 82. Word out is that Bruce Springsteen's got a new album out. Oh my gosh. But then we're waiting. This is going to be this tremendous E Street Band album, right? Oh my gosh. This one's going to go off the charts. It's going to go take them through the roof. We're all waiting. I saw several shows in 81 and 82, or I mean in 80 and 81, and couldn't wait for a new Bruce Springsteen album. I was in high school. I mean, I'm just, I mean, there was electricity coming out of my body when I'm thinking about Bruce Springsteen. And then here comes this album, released in September of 1982, called Nebraska. And first of all, on the cover, no picture of Bruce Springsteen. I mean, Born to Run's got the classic picture of him and Clarence. Darkness on the Edge of Town has a picture of him with the leather jacket. The River has a full in-your-face close-up with just wearing a flannel, just reinforcing the Bruce Springsteen image. And here comes Nebraska with a black and red cover design and a black and white photo of just a stark road. No picture on the back side, just a listing of the songs. When you pull the album out, a few black and white photos of him sitting in a kitchen, very subdued, very odd. This is not the big Bruce Springsteen follow-up to the River album that anybody expected. If anybody said they did, don't listen to him. I was there. I know. I remember when I put the album on, I was reading articles, reviews. Of course, the critics got big reviews because it was a bold and brave creative statement, especially in the face of the huge fame and especially in the face of these expectations to come out and release an album of basically demos that was recorded in his bedroom on a small TAC recorder, which I've seen in person now. It's a part of the mythology. I've seen it in different exhibitions at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and other places. But this album, because it was a demo, he was in his house. He was writing demos for the band. And those songs wound up being the album. In fact, he recorded this with just an engineer, a friend of his, and with just a guitar. And, they overdubbed a few little things later. But for the most part, it was a guitar, a harmonica, and a microphone in his basement or in his bedroom at the house he had at the time in Colts Neck, New Jersey. And these songs, in many ways, were meant to be the demos that were taken to be recorded with the band. In fact, they were. Many of them were recorded with the majority of the E Street Band to become the next Bruce Springsteen album with the E Street Band. But there was something going on. The tone of these songs, the messages of the songs, the themes of these songs were very, as I said before, very dark and very intimate. They weren't about out on the street or at the Cadillac Ranch or having a hungry heart. These were desolate. These were isolated. These were about criminals and murderers. And other songs were very, very small and fragile. Reminiscences of his childhood. A song called My Father's House or Used Cars or Mansion on the Hill. They were quiet. They were visual pictures. They were almost cinematic. They were little stories. They weren't really made for big giant productions. They weren't anthems. They were small little story snapshots. Although they were initially meant to be. And several versions and several of the songs were recorded with the full band. I don't think Clarence Clemons was a part of them. But at the end of the day, despite recording several different sessions of these songs, Springsteen still had the cassette, the original demo cassette that he'd carry around with him. And he'd play it for people. What are you up to, Bruce? Well, here's what I'm up to. And people would be, wow, you know. And after the recording of these sessions with the band in a very unorthodox and tough sell, and I think you'll see it in the film from what I've seen, and I can only imagine. I mean, let's be, if you're Columbia Records and you just finally got your payday off of Bruce Springsteen after years of hype and marketing and expectations, now you finally got it. You know they wanted another Hungry Heart. You know they wanted another Cadillac Ranch and another, Out in the Street and things like that. Another Sherry Darling. And they were presented with this dark and distant. It was haunting. I mean, it was recorded in his bedroom. And this is back 40 years ago. Recording equipment isn't like it was today. This is not digital. This is tape. This is very, you know, bare bone stuff. The quality had to really be upped because it wasn't really meant to be released. It was meant to be used as a blueprint for the band. But ultimately, Springsteen felt like, you know, the way they were written and the way they were recorded, that's the way they need to be heard. And that's where he felt he was then. And as I think you're going to see in the film, if what we heard later, he was trying to find himself, even though as a young kid, as an outcast kid who had been dreaming of rock and roll success, of being thought of and known as one of the greatest rock stars in the world, he had finally achieved that after years of plugging along since he was a teenager, 15 years at least. He finally hit that pinnacle that he had always dreamed about. And instead of embracing it and leaning into it and making it bigger and more, he went just the opposite direction. And so here came Nebraska. Critically acclaimed and yet still some people on the fence. Yes, it's bold. Yes, it's experimental. It's brave of him to do. But even the critics, in many ways, were looking for that big Bruce Springsteen promise fulfilled. And so Nebraska comes out with a lot of head scratching. And it sold okay. It had no singles that were on the radio. They were played a little, and then it quickly went away. It was certainly on the list of many people's best albums of the year from a critical standpoint because, once again, it was an artistic statement. It was far from a huge financial success or a mainstream success. Fans knew it. In fact, in many ways, it was considered a fans-only album. I mean, if you were a Bruce Springsteen fan, you'd listen to this thing a lot and you'd come to appreciate for what it was. But certainly, in 1982, as MTV and music was beginning to explode, and certainly it was coming over from Britain with the synthesizers, big, loud productions were coming in. That's what the 80s music represented. High tech, synthesizers, electronic drum machines, big sounds, and here comes Bruce Springsteen with a microphone, a harmonica, and a guitar. Recorded in his bedroom. Talking about murderers and criminals and and you know, as I said, very intimate and personal recollections of his childhood. It was as if he deliberately was stepping away from fame instead of stepping into it. Something that he had dreamed about and worked for and with his huge ambition strove so hard for, and when he got it, somehow he was unfulfilled. Somehow he didn't know where he was or who he was. And so he stepped away from the fame machine with Nebraska as opposed to stepping into it. And as I said, I remember buying it and putting it on and going, I liked it, but it wasn't what I expected. I have to admit, my first reaction was disappointment. There was a couple of rockers on there, like the song Open All Night, which is still one of my favorite songs. I remember being very touched and motivated by the Charlie Starkweather song, Nebraska. I really liked his vocal on that, and I liked the storytelling. It was different. It was interesting. It was engaging. But there was still a disappointment if you were a Bruce Springsteen fan because you were waiting for that E Street Band. We had been telling everybody for years how great this guy was. In 1980, he finally allowed us to prove what we were talking about. And then when you're waiting for the cherry on the sundae, here comes this very weird song about a murderer that gets the electric chair, or a mass murderer, a story about Atlantic City, about the corruption of Atlantic City and mob deaths, or very quiet songs about being embarrassed about having a used car, or going into the neighborhood and seeing these rich mansions and Springsteen coming from this very deprived, lower middle class existence. I mean, wow, it was so different than anybody expected. It was so different than anything that Bruce Springsteen had projected to the public at that time. As I said, perhaps this was the real Bruce Springsteen. And the other one that we had come to know was the creation. But at the time, we didn't know that. And so this was a head scratcher. And then, of course, the album basically came and went. Bruce Springsteen fans bought it. They liked it. Some people, to show how cool they were, would say, oh, I love Nebraska. But at the time, Nebraska was kind of a oddity, and everybody was waiting for the next one. For some reason, it just seemed like Nebraska was some kind of a speed bump that for some reason, Bruce, I don't know what this was, but hopefully the next one's going to be the one we want. And it is, and that's exactly what happened. In 1984, he put out Born in the USA, which ironically, a few of the songs from Born in the USA were also written during this Nebraska time. Songs like Born in the USA and Downbound Train. But wow, were they presented differently on that album, which was much more commercially based, much more slickly produced. Born in the USA succeeded on what it was meant to do. It was meant to take Bruce Springsteen to the next level and make him a super mega star, a stratospheric rock star. These weren't going to be sparse, introspective demos. Born in the USA album was a commercialized version of the Bruce Springsteen sound. If The River was the live, more raw version, closer to the concert Bruce Springsteen, if Nebraska was a stripped down oddity, another side of Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA was meant to be a million seller. It was made that way. And it achieved that. And it made Bruce Springsteen forever one of the biggest rock stars of all time and a legend. He would have been something of a legend without Born in the USA. But he wouldn't have been the Pete Seeger or the Woody Guthrie. He wouldn't have been playing at President Obama's inauguration. He probably wouldn't have a Kennedy Center honor. He probably wouldn't have an Academy Award, and he wouldn't be known as perhaps the America's songwriter poet laureate. He is now a part of the American lexicon. He would have been a popular rock star, but Born in the USA allowed him to take his career to other areas and really become, as I said before, a legend. And that's what that album was meant to do. But Nebraska was so just, what the heck is it? And so I'm going to be interested to see this film because, as I said before, this is a very short period of time. This takes place between like 81 and 82. It's going to be, you're going to see portions of Bruce, the bigger Bruce Springsteen. But for the most part, you're going to see a very solemn, a very tortured, a very unsure, a very struggling and searching Bruce Springsteen, which in many ways is what the songs on Nebraska represent. Perfect example. After Born in the USA, sold 15, 20 million copies, whatever it is, made him an MTV star, he was selling out concerts with 50 or 60 or 70,000 people all around the world. In 1984 and 85, Bruce Springsteen's fame was ridiculous. It was off the charts. And so here we go again, just to show my point about retreating from fame. In 1984, Born in the USA comes out. He tours with it for 2 years. He puts out a live album in 1986, which everybody had been clamoring for because he was such a great live artist. Everybody had all these bootleg albums with bad sound that were recorded by people with the little hand recorders. And now we finally had some real live, official, well-recorded and mixed live Bruce Springsteen songs. And then he got married, which surprised everybody. And in 1987, everybody's waiting now for the follow-up. We had this live album, right, which is more of the Bruce Springsteen and E Street Band sound. We had Born in the USA, which is this great big, you know, stylized, commercialized Bruce Springsteen album. Now he's a commodity. You know, little seven-year-old kids were going as Bruce Springsteen for Halloween that year with wearing white T-shirts and jeans with a red baseball cap in their back pocket, okay? That's where he had gotten to that point. Seven-year-olds were going to the concerts, okay? That's how mainstream he had become. That's how popular he had become. He went from this cult star to this megastar. And so everybody's saying, okay, well, wow, what's the next Bruce? Here we go again. Wow, what's the next one going to be like? And what does he do? He puts out an album called Tunnel of Love, which is, once again, a somewhat homemade album, a little more produced than the last one. But for the most part, while it features members of the E Street Band, they never played together. This album was, again, kind of produced in a very Nebraska-like way, but enhanced with overdubs, bringing in members of the band. But it wasn't a band album per se. And it was a very personal album. And it reflected kind of the, once again, the searching and the doubt, because now he was in the midst of a marriage, and it was clear that the marriage, there were problems. These were songs about disappointment and relationships in question or in discord or in complex areas. These were not really huge love songs. They were more about a question of what's going on. More introspection, when you'd have expected Bruce to once again lean into the fame and the E Street Band sound, the big booming Clarence Clemons, Max Weinberg, Danny Federici E Street Band, you know, Roy Bittan E Street Band sound, comes Tunnel of Love with songs like Brilliant Disguise, about a married man who's saying that I'm showing you one side, but I'm really this way. Another song called One Step Up and Two Steps Back, about betrayal and infidelity. Two faces have I, one that laughs, that one that cries. I show you this face, but I'm really that. Tunnel of Love, this dark ride, amusement ride with twists and turns and dark and surprises. And sure enough, about a year or so later, Bruce Springsteen was found to be having an affair with one of his backup singers, Patti Scalfa, who he wound up marrying, but still, he was, during the 1988 tour, he was photographed on a Rome balcony in the morning with Patti Scalfa. And so what was being hinted at or being intimated about on Tunnel of Love wound up to be true about a year or so later. But this is my point. He once again, just like Nebraska with Tunnel of Love, he stepped away from the fame instead of stepping into the fame. And it's been a reoccurring theme throughout his career. In the 90s, he put out another very dark and solo album called The Ghost of Tom Joad. Much more produced, not done so much in a bedroom like Nebraska, but very Nebraska-like. And even Devils and Dust later on, another kind of solo-ish, stripped-down project. Every time there have been expectations for a big, booming Bruce Springsteen comeback, he's always seemed to retreat from it. The fame that he so strove for and lusted after and finally achieved, the fame, the fortune, you name it. He had everything. He has everything. And instead of reveling in it, he always seems to have stepped back. And the first time he really did that was with Nebraska in 1982. And so that's what you're going to see in this film called Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere. And that's what you're going to hear on this new expanded version called Nebraska 82. It's got like five CDs. There's a, as I said before, he went back now 40 some years later and re-recorded all the songs with just him and one other musician with a little accompaniment. No audience. Basically trying to recreate as much as he could the Nebraska experience now 40 some years later, a remaster of the album. Then of course the Holy Grail, the thing that Bruce Springsteen fans have been waiting for 40 some years, the E Street Band recordings of the Nebraska material that have never been heard. No bootlegs have ever leaked out on this. This has been the Holy Grail. This was Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys' Smile. This was Prince's Black Album. Any kind of unreleased album that you'd always heard about that took on mythic proportions, the electric Nebraska was the one for Bruce Springsteen fans. We'd seen him do Nebraska songs in concert with the full band, especially Atlantic City. And for me, when I heard the Atlantic City first done with the band and the great arrangement, I said to myself, well, this doesn't make any sense. We were told that these songs didn't sound right or couldn't be played by the E Street Band. But wow, listen to that version of Atlantic City. From my standpoint, that's a great version. That's an E Street Band version. That's a great version. But as I said before, from an artistic standpoint, and I think more from a personal standpoint, Bruce Springsteen was in his own head. And I think he looked at the way those songs sounded with the E Street Band. And I think, and I haven't heard these yet either, I think he purposely was not hearing what was really there, because he really felt in his mind that these dark, stark, haunting versions with just him and the guitar, as uncommercial as they may be, those were the most real and authentic and primary versions of the song. Even though I think we're going to hear that when the E Street Band did them, because they're such a great band of musicians, I bet you those songs sounded great. But if his head was in a different place, that means his ears were in a different place. And maybe he didn't even want to hear the way those sounded, because somewhere maybe he wanted to release these. And with his manager, John Landau, being his greatest proponent, was able to get those out. It was his way of his step. He wanted to step back from that. And perhaps he knew that those songs would only perpetuate that Bruce Springsteen image that he seemed to be now retreating from after years of promoting it. And it helped him achieve what he wanted. And so from that aspect, the film and this album are very exciting and very intriguing. Even though at the time, 43 years ago, this album was a what is this? This album was only in the collections of real Bruce Springsteen fans. For many people, it was an afterthought. I would argue that many Bruce Springsteen fans have gone back to rediscover it and give it another chance, because at the time, I guarantee you, this album was viewed as a weird disappointment by many Bruce Springsteen fans, only to have been made up for that with the big commercial sound of Born in the USA, which then once again had the longtime fans saying, there's the Bruce Springsteen. But ironically, 40 years later, the Nebraska Bruce Springsteen is now the one that he's closer to. And the Bruce Springsteen from the Born in the USA album kind of feels a little manufactured, a little commercialized. Over the years, Bruce Springsteen from Nebraska is the Bruce Springsteen of 2025, not the one from 1984. He's not wearing the headbands. He's not wearing the cutoff flannels. He's more of an American troubadour. He's more of a folk storyteller. And that's what Nebraska is. And so, as I said, you can look at this and say, it was a departure for Bruce Springsteen, Nebraska, but maybe it was actually the authentic Bruce Springsteen and the other Bruce Springsteen that we knew. The Born to Run Bruce Springsteen, the River Bruce Springsteen, maybe that was the creation. And the Nebraska Bruce Springsteen was the real one. Every artist worth their salt is complex. Is complicated. The best artists are the ones that in many ways you can't understand. You can't describe. What you do is you immerse yourself in their creative art and you are moved by that. And if you can find bits and pieces of them in there, that's the revelation. But you also have to remember that they're artistic. Part of them is in the art and part of them is away from it. They are also observers of it. And I think that's what Bruce Springsteen music has been when you look at his catalog over the last 50 years. And Nebraska is important, and it has taken on, as I said now, legendary, mythic proportions. And with this film and with this box set, which of course now will also bring to light these electric versions, these E Street Band versions. This is a very important piece of the puzzle, because it was perhaps the first time that the real Bruce Springsteen was revealed, even though at the time we didn't know it. And at the time we didn't even want it. But with time, we've understood that that's what he wanted. So I hope you'll see the film. I'm looking forward to it. And maybe you'll go out and buy the album as well. But I would expect that this, from what I've seen, Jeremy Allen White is probably going to get nominated for an Academy Award because Hollywood loves Bruce Springsteen anyway. I don't know how the film's going to do at the box office. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure Bruce fans are going to run out and go see it. It'll be interesting to see what kind of reviews it gets when it comes out. As I said before, the media has always loved Bruce Springsteen, so I can't believe, even if it's not a great album, he's going to get the benefit, or a great film, I think he's going to get the benefit of the doubt, because the media has been one of the greatest proponents of Bruce's career as well. He has really, even though he's made a lot of mistakes, like many artists have, the media hasn't always followed up and dug deep. They've bought into the myth too sometimes because they're fans, and that's where the subjectivity comes in too. And he certainly has benefited from that. But there's no question that that this film and this new box set, Nebraska 82, the expanded version, is going to now establish Nebraska as one of, if not the best Bruce Springsteen albums and one of the must listen to Bruce Springsteen albums. It is ironically now going to elevate this album that 40 years ago, no one would ever have thought would have risen to this kind of respect, this kind of awareness, and this kind of popularity. But from now on, when you hear about Bruce Springsteen's career, I guarantee you, you're going to hear about Nebraska. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 491. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of my mind to your ears.